The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, another day, another party at number 10 Downing Street comes to light. The pressure is on British PM Boris Johnson. We'll have the latest from Westminster. Also ahead...
It's about election subversion, not just whether or not people get to vote. Who counts the vote? That's what this is about. That's what makes this so different. Anything else we've ever done.
US President Joe Biden meets with Senate Democrats to talk voting rights legislation. Then our Andrew Muller recaps the last 7 days for us on this week's What We Learned.
We learned that the gates of hell are to close and all reasonable people will agree that it is not before time.
And our editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck will be here too to bid farewell to the Marble Arch Mound. He'll tell us why cities don't need to spend millions on pop-up pap to keep people happy. All that ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. We start right here in the UK, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson woke up facing fresh calls to resign after more news overnight that there were two other parties at number 10 Downing Street on the eve of the Duke of Edinburgh's socially distanced funeral. We're joined now for more on this by the journalist and broadcaster Nadine Batchelor-Hunt. Nadine, just tell us exactly what we've learned overnight and remind us of some of the context here and what the Queen herself had to do on the day or the day following these latest parties.
Well, it seems to have emerged that the Prime Minister's former Director of Communications, James Black, had some sort of a leaving do on the evening before the Queen buried her husband, Prince Philip. And, you know, you had that kind of, which kind of now has become a personally iconic photo of her sitting alone in the church. And in many ways, for many Brits, seemed to embody the loneliness of the pandemic and how, you know, you couldn't even mourn your loved ones. So this, you know, particularly, already the parties were an emotive topic for millions and millions of Brits. Many of which didn't get to see their family members in their last hours or didn't get to bury them as they needed to, as you would expect in normaler times. But also, you know, the Queen holds a very special place in the British psyche. And for, you know, many, many Brits, seeing this is going to feel unpatriotic. It's going to feel like the ultimate betrayal. You know, the UK overwhelmingly, you know, when you look at polls, supports the Queen. So, yeah, this is very... a very sticky situation for number 10. And I think what's been quite striking is that number 10 came out this morning and said it was a farewell speech. Now, as somebody who's been working in the lobby on this over the last few weeks, they've repeatedly refused to confirm or deny allegations of parties, insisting that it's that because they don't want to preempt the inquiry that's going to come next. Surprise, surprise, though, this morning, clearly as a symbol of how the gravitas of these new accusations are, they've immediately come out and said, you know, it was just a farewell speech. So it gives you a sense of the kind of nervousness that's going on in number 10 right now, that they felt the need to come out and say this almost immediately when there's been stonewalling journalists on this for weeks. It's months. I think we're getting to months now.
Yeah, Nadine, exactly. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that sense of growing pressure. Obviously, there was this extraordinary PMQs on Wednesday lunchtime when you could sort of hear a pin drop in the House. And interestingly, we're seeing the tension, the pressure on number 10, and very specifically on Boris and his inner circle, ratcheting up, you know, in the pages of the Telegraph, across all of the British newspapers. And it doesn't now seem to be partisan at all. There seems to be this collective sense of injustice. And it's being articulated by people with their own personal stories, heartbreaking ones, as you say, of not being able to say goodbye to loved ones. And now, you know, the Queen, the figurehead, the icon, a person that even the Telegraph's most committed readers love even more than they used to love Boris. Is the pressure rising, though, to an unsustainable, an unsurvivable degree for Boris? What are you feeling in the corridors of power where you are right now?
So it's interesting, you know, there's kind of a sense, I think, within Labour that, you know, this is the end, that maybe this is going to be the moment now that he's going to go. And I think, you know, so there are some people within Labour that think it's just a matter of time. I think there are some people in the Conservative Party, which has been the sense that they think it's just going to be a matter of time. But then there are other people that think, you know, he's not really going to go anywhere. So I think, you know, I think for the public, in many ways, they maybe are more likely to think he'll resign than not. But I think within Westminster, he's a very, very, I don't know, people call him the Teflon Tory, don't they? He manages to survive things that people within the political universe don't think he will survive over and over again. You know, be it misleading the Queen, you know, this isn't the first time that there's been a bit of a kind of story around him and not necessarily a positive one when it comes to the Queen, you know, misleading her and unlawfully proroguing Parliament back a few years ago, and now this. But he always seems to survive. You know, I mean, how many times have we been here saying, is this the end for Boris Johnson? Is he going to resign? So I personally don't think we can expect to see his resignation. I may eat my words, but, you know, his number 10 have been quite persistent in their line that they're not going to make any statement and there won't be any sort of resignation until Sue Gray's report is released. And I think for me, that is a point that maybe we will see it. But I just can't see him resigning, really, unless he thinks he's going to lose a no-confidence vote at the 1922 committee, which would mean 54 MPs in the Conservative Party would need to submit letters of no-confidence, which would then trigger a leadership, which would then trigger a no-confidence vote. If he thought he was going to lose that, then I think we'd see him resign. But I can't see, you know, more than 150 MPs voting him down in a no-confidence vote. So I personally think he's here to stay. But I think Westminster's quite split at the moment, which is a sign maybe of the times that the tide might be shifting.
Yeah, hugely uncertain. And I was going to ask you a little bit about what we should look for next. I know sometimes it's wrong to try and read the tea leaves, if you like, Nadine, and look for, you know, meaning in other things. Are there imminent, I don't know, other pronouncements, appearances? You know, it's always been very striking. It was striking even on Wednesday, wasn't it, that Rishi Sunak, for example, was like down in the West Country and didn't say anything other than a pretty guarded, he was right to apologise. Interesting to read that. If you don't think that, you know, any pronouncements imminently from the 1922 committee are to be forthcoming. And clearly, we don't know when Sue Gray will report, do we yet? I don't think. So any other things we should look for? Any runes we can read into?
I think keep an eye out for reports of letters going into the 1922 committee. I think that's quite a significant one. They're not sent anonymously, but the chair, for Graham Brady, will not disclose how many has been sent into him. But once a threshold is met and no confidence vote is triggered, the more people will see reports of these letters being sent in, means more MPs are being more outspoken about their dissatisfaction. Then, you know, some of them will openly say, I've sent a no confidence letter in, like Douglas Ross. But then other MPs will just say, you know, say to the Times off the record or something like that and say, you know, I've sent a no confidence letter in, but I'm not going to be named.
We will keep watching that. Nadine, thanks for breaking off from what I know is a pretty sort of febrile and busy atmosphere in Westminster today. Thanks for taking some time to speak to us. That was the journalist and broadcaster Nadine Batchelor-Hunt joining us here on The Briefing. Now let's cross and hear from Monocle's Carlotta Ribello. She's standing by with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. North Korea has fired at least two ballistic missiles, its third test in less than 2 weeks. It came just hours after criticizing the US's push for new sanctions over the previous launches. South Korea's National Security Council has been holding an emergency meeting and has called on Pyongyang to return to talks. A massive cyber attack has hit Ukraine's government websites, warning citizens to be afraid and expect the worst. It hit the Foreign Ministry, the Cabinet of Ministers, and the Security and Defense Councils, and comes as tensions escalate over a possible new Russian military offensive against Ukraine. Australia has revoked the visa of the tennis star Novak Djokovic for a second time, following a row over his vaccination status. The decision could mean he could be deported and get a 3-year visa ban. However, the 34-year-old Serbian can still launch another legal challenge to remain in Australia. And Greece's government has announced that it will raise the minimum wage for a second time later this year, as rising inflation takes a toll on consumers' income. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said the rise in the minimum wage will be a significant one in a bid to offset the impact of inflation. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Tom.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. To the United States now, where President Joe Biden has been meeting in the Capitol with Senate Democrats in a bid to unite the chamber in order to pass voting rights legislation. Democrats see this bill as a last chance to counter new voting restrictions in Republican-controlled states ahead of the upcoming congressional elections in November. Let's hear what Biden had to say as he left the meeting yesterday.
Like every other major civil rights bill that came along, if we missed the first time, we could come back and try it a second time. We missed this time. We missed this time. And the state legislative bodies continue to change the law, not as to who can vote, but who gets to count the vote. Count the vote. Count the vote. It's about election subversion, not just whether or not people get to vote. Who counts the vote? That's what this is about. That's what makes this so different than anything else we've ever done. I don't know that we can get it done, but I know one thing. As long as I have a breath in me, as long as I'm in the White House, as long as I'm engaged at all, I'm going to be fighting to change the way these legislatures have moving.
Well, we're joined now for more on this by Capri Cafaro, who's the former Democratic leader of the Ohio State Senate and is currently a professor at the American University in Washington, D.C., and a fellow at LSE here in London. Capri, thanks for joining us. I guess just to take us a few steps back, first of all, and remind us, what exactly is Joe Biden trying to achieve here?
Sure. Well, you have to put in the context of the backdrop of the 2020 election, where there was so much controversy and acrimony back and forth between state legislatures, their governing bodies dealing with counting the votes, because that's how it is done here in the United States. We have a devolved system where the individual states have jurisdiction over the voting processes. And so because there was a lot of back and forth between, Trump and Trump supporters believing that the voting was not legitimate because there was mail-in ballots and things of that nature at the time. Then, obviously, Joe Biden won the election, particularly because of places like Georgia and Pennsylvania that ended up having mail-in ballots. I'm probably giving you a little bit too much information, but this is important to give you the context of why this is happening right now. So as a result of those things, of this back and forth between those that felt that the 2020 election was not legitimate and then those that were upset about it and started to change and restrict voting access rules at the state level, there was a movement at the federal level to essentially try to centralize voting rules. And so there are two bills that go along with that that are pending in Congress right now. They've passed the House. They are in the Senate. And Joe Biden is facing an uphill battle because of some rules that are specific to the Senate that make it difficult to pass legislation on a simple majority. And that is a problem right now because he needs all of the Democrats to be on board for this rule change to make things pass with a simple majority, 51 votes as opposed to 60. But there are at least two Democrats that are holding out, and it is making it pretty much impossible right now for Joe Biden to achieve this hallmark aspect of the priorities he has for his time in the White House.
Cadbury, that's an excellent summary. Never apologise for providing too much detail. That's what we need to try and make sense of these complexities. And let me ask you a little bit about the infamous kind of filibuster rule, which is kind of at the heart here. Obviously, there was an op-ed, I think, in USA Today from former President Barack Obama talking about the issue. He was talking about efforts, blocking efforts to protect our democracy, these very fundamental questions. Is it an oversimplification to say that wrestling with this filibuster rule is wrestling with the very protection of US democracy, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it is actually more complicated than that. That's you know, my opinion, and I think one that is colored by being a former state legislator for a decade. You know, I mean, there are certainly issues pertaining to, you know, protecting the ability to vote, you know, and because we have this, you know, federalist system where we have basically 50 systems of how we vote, where we vote, when we vote, how votes are counted, it creates a you know, a lack of consistency that sometimes means that voting is easier in some places and harder than others. And that concept, particularly when you're dealing with a national federal election like the presidency, sometimes can feel like there is an inequity when it comes to the ability to exercise a fundamental democratic right. Now, that being said, again, context, you know, the Constitution essentially, you know, leaves a lot of these kind of functions to the states, which is why we have this, you know, 50 state system right now of how votes are and elections are monitored and how ballots are counted. This is an effort basically not to circumvent the Constitution, but essentially to enable, you know, to have federal statute that essentially then would create precedent where you would be centralizing these election functions. As a former state legislator, I would say that, you know, there, because of the way that we have functioned as a nation for so long in our system of federalism, I think that there is something to be said for keeping the system as it is. It's the same kind of, you know, controversy and debates we had over abolishing the Electoral College to elect a president. So I think that there is a larger question here about, you know, the way the American government functions. And that's why I think it's not just as simple as saying this is, you know, the filibuster standing in the way of democracy. The other thing is that the filibuster itself is there to be able to preserve any kind of relevance that the minority has in the legislative process. You know, if you just have a simple majority, you could just essentially pass things through and you silence the minority and the minority becomes entirely irrelevant. This filibuster is a tool in order to enable to continue to have them have at least some participation in the process. Now you could argue that that is not just protecting their right, it is creating a hindrance to things going forward. So there's a lot more here.
Yeah, there's a lot more there. And obviously, a lot of eyes are on what happens in November. And mm-hmm. and there's a great deal of interest, Capri, in just Joe Biden's ongoing performance, you know, in office. What have you made in particular of some of his rhetoric? Because I know that people have heaped quite a lot of opprobrium and criticism on Biden for some of the sort of comparisons he's made. He's made allusions to, you know, challenges before to fundamental freedoms. Do you think that he's, I don't know, tonally sort of misjudged the way that he's talking about these prospective changes even? And how does that fit into your assessment of his, you know, his day-to-day performance dealing with more quotidian matters of office?
Sure. I actually do think that he has missed the mark, you know, in tone and sometimes in substance when it comes to, you know, some of these more recent issues. You know, he did a speech in Georgia about these voting rights issues just a few days ago on the heels of Martin Luther King Day, which we celebrate as a bank holiday here in the United States on Monday. And so in that backdrop of civil rights, you know, he's in Georgia, he's trying to talk about the relevance and the importance of passing these bills. And then, you know, essentially says, you know, anyone that is not supportive of these things is, you know, essentially, you know, a racist and a segregationist by using these, you know, analogies of certain people through American history. And it offended so many people, and including people that, you know, like Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, a Republican who may have been someone that might have, you know, been willing to engage in maybe a more meaningful dialogue on supporting some of this legislation. And so And then it drew ire from the leader, Mitch McConnell. And some of that is, you know, performative, certainly. But, you know, I think that there's an issue there. I also think that the way that the speech he gave in regards to January 6th, the insurrection and everything about it, I think was also missed the mark because he made it about Donald Trump, even though he didn't call him by name. And I think that it politicized a moment that has been overly politicized in this country. And I think one that really shouldn't be because, you know, Democrats and Republicans, including the vice president at the time, Mike Pence, were threatened, were in the seat of democracy, and Biden made it political. And I think that there's a lot of pandering to the progressive wing of the party, a group that he needed that coalition in order to win in 2020. And I think a lot of Democrats feel that coalition continues to grow and is more relevant as demographics change in the United States. And I think that, you know, he's coming off disingenuous, and I think it's hurting him. And look, and there's a lot of other issues here that are not helping, you know, the matters with Omicron and inflation and a bunch of other factors that are somewhat out of his control. But it's definitely an uphill battle and for Joe Biden, and it's going to hurt, I think, Democrats in the midterm elections.
Yeah, Capri, I just want to ask you a kind of almost as a personal question, really. When you have these turbulent moments these days when there's all of this complexity and nuance on the floor happening in D.C., I don't know, what do you personally miss, you know, being right in the heart of that cut and thrust? It's funny, reflecting on some of your remarks and writings since, I sense maybe it's all a lot of stress that you're happy you don't have. But do you miss it a little? Would you like to be right in the mix of it?
Well, I miss being able to be part of solving problems and helping people. I don't necessarily miss, you know, the political acrimony. And it's one of the reasons why I've, you know, chosen not to seek elected office at a time where, you know, I probably could, you know, run in this midterm election for a different office and have chosen not to because, you know, there's a great level of dysfunction. And, you know, and that's paired with, you know, divisiveness and, you know, growing, you know, hatred amongst both the public for, you know, the government and, you know, internal strife within government. And so it's unfortunate. I've gone back and forth myself trying to say, well, you know, if you want to change it, you got to be part of the solution. But I think at this point in my life, I don't think that it's the right time, you know, particularly because I don't think I can get anything done. But, which is really just sad. You know, you're only one person in the legislative, you know, process. It's difficult to, you know, you're one of you know, hundreds of people in certain circumstances. And it's very sad. I find it very sad where we're at in the United States. And I'm hopeful that, you know, at some point we will course correct and end this divisiveness and recognize that government is there to solve problems and to serve people. But right now, I don't think that our elected leaders are focused on either.
No, not a great moment in that respect. Well, let's hope that, that course correct happens and we can get some more thoughtful people like yourself back on the front lines. Capri Cufaro, really great to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is a Friday, which means Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, has been hard at work, honestly, summarising the events of the past 7 days. Here he is with this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week quite a lot about the hair's breadth that apparently separates a work event from a party, as UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson continued to assure the obdurate cohort of the certifiable who still believe him that the party he attended at 10 Downing Street in May 2020 was, in fact, a work event.
And when I went into that garden just after 6 on the 20th of May 2020, to thank groups of staff before going back into my office 25 minutes later to continue working, I believed implicitly that this was a work event,
We learned that at a time when many millions of British people had resorted to posting boring photos of bread to pass the lockdown days amidst the birthdays, weddings, holidays and funerals they had forsworn in the name of protecting public health, number 10 was difficult to distinguish from Studio 54. An observation which we now realise is not altogether congruent with the soundtrack we have picked. We know what you were expecting. You were expecting a 70s disco hit with the word party in the title, which would set up some interminable hack riff where we swapped out the word party from song titles and replaced it with work event to leaden satirical effect. You know, get this work event started, work event hard, work event fears too, 24-hour work event people, it's my work event, and I'll cry if I want to. Well, we have chosen at this time to rise nobly above such tawdry japery in recognition of the seriousness of the troubles besetting the Prime Minister and the gravity of the decision about the future leadership of this country now faced by his fellow members of the Parliamentary Conservative Work Event. Anyway, Yes, Warden threw a work event in the county jail, etc., but we are moving on, for we learned that Jailhouse Rock might soon require the addition of many, many more supplementary verses, because the United States is shortly going to have to build more prisons. Quite a lot more, if it turns out that Mike Lindell, soft furnishings impresario and prominent Donald Trump surrogate, is right.
We already have all the pieces of the puzzle, and you talk about evidence. We had enough evidence to put everybody in prison for life, 300 and some million people. We had that all the way back to November, December.
Mike Lindell's ambitious plan to incarcerate 300 million, i.e. nearly all of his fellow Americans, for committing the mass voter fraud which deprived his friend and patron Donald Trump of the presidency of the United States, may sound of a piece with several of Lindell's previous interesting, let's go with interesting, claims regarding the legitimacy of the 2020 election. However, we learned, well, more sort of surmised, really, that Lindell may be onto something here. Restoring Trump to the White House might well set Lindell up for reward, like a contract for his company, MyPillow, to supply bedding to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. A gig which would be well worth having if that many people are bound for the hooskow, the more so when one is, as Lindell is, looking down the barrel of a $1.3 billion lawsuit from one enraged manufacturer of voting machines. So we learned, again, that the overturning of the 2020 US presidential election remains surely just a matter of time, so long as legal minds of the caliber of Trump's outriders stay on the case. And
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
We learned that the gates of hell are to close, and all reasonable people will agree that it is not before time. However, we learned after scrolling beyond the headline that this development is perhaps not as encouraging as it sounds. The gates of hell in this instance are not the mystical portal to the malevolent underworld from which has sprung war, famine, pestilence, death, and e-scooters, but a natural gas crater in Turkmenistan. We learned, after embarking on the rigorous research expected by the exacting listeners of these monologues, that the Dvazha crater has been ablaze since 1971, when Soviet geologists drilled into the wrong bit of Karakum Desert. Doubtless something like that, yes. Since then, the Inferno has become both tourist attraction and propaganda prop. In 2019, Turkmenistan's weirdo president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, had himself filmed driving around it to dispel persistent rumours that he was dead. But we learned that it is now President Berdimuhamedov himself who has decided that the gates of hell must be closed, the fire doused. And yes, we are right now going to embark on a total non sequitur just so we can play that clip again, hopefully so he is less distracted by the desire to pull donuts around a blazing cavity and can better concentrate on his rapping. everybody on the chorus. Turkmenistan, Turkmenistan. How is amazing place I was at. Gasping the waves and bursting it down. Life is so wonderful in my life. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew Muller. And it is from one Andrew to another that we pass now, because in the crosshairs next, it's the Marble Arch Mound here in London. The 82-foot-tall artificial hill opened last July and was greeted with ire from the public, slammed for being ugly, a waste of money, and for bearing little resemblance to the renders, the beautiful renders that had done the rounds before it opened. Despite the hefty price tag, more than £5 million, the installation's officially closed this week. Work has begun to dismantle it, and I am joined by that other Andrew. It's Monocle's editor-in-chief and host of The Urbanist, no less, Andrew Tuck. Hello, Andrew.
Thank you very much for having me to talk about this, this sad end of a very sad story.
It is an extraordinary demise. Let's sort of roll the clock back to when it opened, and I know you spoke to the architect of the hill at the time, and there was a great deal of discussion about the idea, the concept of it. Does the fact that it's had this short-lived and frankly seemingly rather unsuccessful lifespan marry up with what your expectations were as you articulated them at the time?
Completely. So I think what was interesting is, you know, that cities around the world felt that they needed to be doing things to get their economies going, to make sure that retail was thriving back in the summer. And this was an example of that. This was the idea that you'd build this fake hill at the end of Oxford Street next to Marble Arch, and that it would lure in hundreds of thousands of people who would then wander off down Oxford Street spending their money, which is a retail strip that's really, really suffering. So they built this thing, but the trouble was that they had over-egged it in the beginning, because they put out these images, these renders, these CADs from the architects that made it look as though they were going to build a mountain and it was going to be covered in rich vegetation. And it looked glorious. And then the reality was that consent was more difficult to get. They couldn't build over the arch after all. They had to be a bit shorter. And actually, when it came to putting the plants on, whoever had done those original mock-ups had just got way too carried away. Instead of hundreds of mature trees, there were like a few spindly sticks. And when we went to check it out for The Urbanist, many of those were dying. That the sedum, it wasn't grass, this weird sedum was patchy and bald. It was sad.
It was always a bit of a sad thing. And I guess the sorry chapter looks like it might take sort of 4 months to dismantle it, which is probably almost as long as it took to put the thing up in the first place. Tell us though, Andrew, with your knowledge of how these decisions are made in city halls and with, you know, local authorities, how do you get it so wrong? I mean, I don't want to point fingers, but is it something that sits with Westminster Council? What was Mr. Ricken himself, the architect? It seemed like he kind of knew it was a bit of a funny project even at the outset. How does something that costs so much money and is so poor at delivering what it's supposed to do, how does that happen?
Well, as I said, the images were wrong in the first place. They weren't corrected. They were allowed to be, you know, pumped out to all the media. So the expectation level could never, ever be met. The cost thing for this just ran away from them. So what was meant to be, I think, a million plus budget, as you say, ended up at 5 million. It's taken the jobs of people on the councils. It's kind of embarrassed everybody. And I think that it turns out that these things aren't as easy to do. They need a bit more planning and foresight and, you know, a pop-up little kind of stall on the edge of your market is fine. But when you build something this quickly, it's difficult. But what it should be contrasted with is when we looked across to Paris, almost at exactly the same time, they had Christo's wrapping of the Arc de Triomphe. And every single person who went to Paris went to see it, took a photo, uploaded it to their social media accounts, and really promoted Paris in a big way. Whereas I just never saw anybody kind of engaging with that mound, no posting of any pictures. And as you say, we should have to point out, the other strange thing is MVRDV, who are the architects behind this project, are an amazing architecture practice out of the Netherlands. Vinnie Maas, who runs it, has spoken at many a Monocle event. It's a great company. Occasionally, you just get things wrong.
Well, to that point then, what should they have thought about? Because it doesn't seem like it has boosted footfall in Oxford Street, which, as you said, is still quite beleaguered. It's getting better, and it will get better quickly in 2022. if you're looking at, and it was a domestic play, wasn't it? It was to get domestic shoppers and things walking and buying and spending. What are the things that really do deliver, Andrew? Obviously, you can do the big marquee thing like the wrapping of the Arc de Triomphe, as you said. But just generally, if you want to get people to walk down a popular street, shouldn't you close it to traffic? Or shouldn't you have nice places for people to sit? Do you not need to green an environment that's a bit too heavy with concrete? Isn't it more about doing those things than these big marquee spends?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that obviously they're concerned about the rent. The Westminster Council, who paid for this project, they were concerned about, you know, rents and income from Oxford Street. But it was trying to stick a plaster on something that's none of their business in a way, which is the failure of mid-market retail. So they've seen lots of these department stores close. There's nothing they can do to turn that around. They should leave that to the companies and brands who are on the street to either fold and go away and be replaced by something better, or to up their game. They can't fix retail. So I think the initial ambition was a bad one. You shouldn't go out there trying to fix retail. Yes, entertain people. Yes, have a folly. Let's do something extraordinary. But it was neither of those things. And it had this strange master, this idea of fixing the world of retail, which it could never do. Whereas something like the wrapping of the Arc de Triomphe was meant to be a glory just in itself. It was of itself, and it worked.
Andrew, really interesting to hear your insights. And if you think, hang on, Monocle's editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck there, he's being a bit wise after the fact, head on back through the archive. Episode 513, it was, of The Urbanist, if memory serves. And you can hear the report on the Marble Arch Mound and interview with that architect behind the project, and you'll see that we can confidently say we told you so.
I've been rude from the beginning.
There you go. Thanks, Andrew. That's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett. Our studio manager was Chris Blackwell. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. That's noon in London, 1300 across CET. I'm Tom Edwards. Have a great weekend, and thank you for listening.